That's what I was going to say. So I won't repeat what you just said. But Christian Arcan is here in studio with us as well. And by the way, that was Kendrick Perkins talking about the relationship between Jason Tatum and Jalen Brown. At least he didn't say you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube like we've heard 48,000 times.
That ship has sailed. Cat's out of the bag.
That's right. What was the one thing you can't...
Can't unring the bell.
Yeah, no, you can't do any of those things. But I was saying earlier, you know, it could end all that if Jason Tatum just put out one tweet saying, I love this guy or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that can end it. But there has been so many... There's been so many angles and so many different things to read from the last 48 hours with the failed Giannis trade. So we need to get an expert on here, someone who can straighten us out. Noah Delzell, this is her first time on the show with us. She's a writer for Celtics blog and You Got Boston podcast. You should follow her at actually, you know what? I want to make sure I'm doing it. Is it at Noah Dalzell, Noah?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right, excellent. She is a must follow if you are a Celtics fan. And so Noah... what do you make of what's happened over the last 48 hours as far as the future of Jalen Brown on the Celtics is concerned?
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss here. And I'd be lying if I said I knew for sure what was going on and what's going to happen in the future. I don't think anybody really knows. But my read on the situation is that at some point since the conclusion of the regular season, you know, after the playoffs, you know, when they blew the 3-1 lead, between then and now, something along the lines of the relationship between the Celtics and Jalen has been, you know, hindered. And whether it's exclusively because they offered him in a trade to Milwaukee for Giannis or because of other things that we don't really have the kind of context right now, I'm not sure. But listening to Brad Stevens talk, I was at the Auerbach Center the other night after the first round of the draft, and normally he would just say confidently, you know, Jalen Brown is a critical part of our future. We want him here. We are going to work to make this happen. And he didn't say that. And I think he could have just said, listen, when a generational Hall of Fame player like Giannis becomes available, you have to inquire, and that's what we did. And we're really happy with our core. And I feel like I was a little surprised. If you'd asked me, we'd been doing this before that press conference, I would have said, I think Jalen's going to stick around, and this was more exclusive to just a Giannis offer. But now, in the days to follow, I get the sense that this might be the end of the road for him in Boston.
Yeah, Noah, you asked Brad a great question about the whole, you know, Jalen Brown said that he would be around for 10 years and or he would play here for 10 years if you had him. And you're right. It was like it seemed like Brad was using past tense when talking about Jalen Brown and his time here and how much they've loved having him here. And now you've even got Brian Windhorst saying that he's gone, like he's 100% convinced. If you had to put a percentage on whether or not he is going to be a member of the Celtics at the beginning of next season, what would that percentage be?
I think there's like a 30% chance he'll be a Celtic next year. Wow. And that's just, again, that's just my intuition. And I honestly don't love to say that because I think that they're much better off having him here in Boston. Unless they were to get a player like Giannis, like they're probably not going to get better with this kind of trade. But that's just my gut feeling. Like I have a hard time envisioning him here back in Boston after the way the summer has unfolded. And we do know that this team feels like they were not good enough, right? That was like where I first realized it was not just a bad series against Philadelphia. Brad Stevens looked at us 2 days later and said, we were not good enough. Our record wasn't as good as it seemed. We weren't good against good teams. And I think that has a lot to do with what we're seeing here is that there's not a lot of ways to dramatically change this roster if you keep two Supermax contracts on the books. So, yeah, I don't think he's going to be back anymore. I feel like all the indications are pointing against that, but I'm kind of bummed to say that, honestly, because I think that there's a good chance that this could be a mistake for this franchise.
By the way, a little bit of breaking news. Jalen Brown has just tweeted that he will be going live on his Twitch stream at 5 p.m. Jeez. Eastern, so he's going to be talking again. He, along with Whale and Smino,
oh, wow.
Who I'm not familiar with. So
Wally?
I don't.
Oh yeah,
Wally.
Wally. Yeah, who's actually playing across the street here from Fenway Park?
That shows you how old and white I am.
It's a rapper, so, Ken.
Okay. Well, they'll be going. They'll be going live at 5. So, Noah, a quick question though: if you're right and they do move on, and it seems like everybody's going that way, who are they in the market for? I don't even know who to root for anymore. Who is the big target that they're looking at?
I don't know. I mean, it has to be a front court player, right? That's what this roster is currently lacking. I know Chris Mannix reported that other teams speculated there was some interest in Evan Mobley. I'm not sure that trade honestly makes sense for Cleveland or for Boston, but we'll see. And then you look around the league, it's like there's Rudy Gobert with the Wave, you know, or Minnesota's made their big splash for LaMelo Ball. I'd be surprised if they moved on from yet another piece of last year's team. There's nobody that's really exciting me that much. I mean, I like Trey Murphy from New Orleans. Reportedly, he you know, they're looking to move on from him, or they're very much open to trading him. I think he's a great scorer. He's somebody that's young. His best days are probably ahead of him, but he's not Jaylen Brown, right? So it's possible that what we see here now that the Giannis ship has sailed, that they turn him for, you know, they trade him for parts and picks and things that maybe down the road make this team better, but in the immediate short term make this team worse. And instinctively I'm against that because it feels like this quarter, this championship window has not yet closed and you still have Jason Tatum in his prime and Derek White. And I feel like they could still make this thing work. But listen, it's hard to also doubt Brad Stevens with the track record that he has, where almost every move he's made as general manager has, you know, turned out to be the right move when you look back at it. So he knows what he's doing. It's just right now it does feel like I have to wonder if maybe Jaylen wants out or if there's a reason why there's an urgency to trade him. And maybe there's not. And maybe my gut instinct is wrong. I wouldn't be disappointed. But sitting at that press conference, all Brad had to say is, you know, we want him here in Boston in the fall. And that's our hope. And that's our intention. And we're going to work hard to make that happen. And I would think, okay, maybe there's a relationship to be mended, but they want him back. And that's just not the way that he sounded at the podium.
Yeah, totally. And Noah, we're going to put you on hold for 1 second because your phone's a little cracked. We're going to reestablish your phone connection. So hang on 1 sec. We're going to put you on hold, and Jackson's going to call you right back. And in the meantime, Stiz, could you play the clip of Shams talking about this trade that LaMelo Ball was just involved in and how it affected Jaylen Brown, or how they were targeting Jaylen Brown as well? Do you happen to have that clip by any chance there, Stiz?
This is why the Timberwolves, though, made this deal, right? Like, they needed an infusion of talent, someone at that point guard slot. They want someone to come in and take the onus off of Anthony Edwards when they need it. And there were two paths that the Timberwolves were taking the last 24, 48 hours. It was seeing, can we go get LaMelo Ball? Or can we go get Jaylen Brown? They had conversations with the Celtics about Jaylen Brown the last 24 hours, but it always comes down to price. How much do you have to pay? Do you have to give up 2-3 of your core pieces? They're not willing to trade Jaden McDaniels at this point. Mm-mm. Him and Anthony Edwards, that relationship, how much they feel like Jaden McDaniels has taken that step to be a star caliber player. So if you can go get LaMelo Ball, yes, you're getting off of Naz Reid. He's a high-level rotation player for you. He was going to step into the starting role.
Okay, that's all I need for Shams. It doesn't it seem, you know, maybe I'll ask Noah. Is Noah back? Let's see. We got her.
There she is.
Noah, thanks. Sorry about that. We just had to adjust your phone connection real quick. Noah, do you think that, because we just heard, obviously, that, you know, LaMelo Ball was chosen over Jaylen Brown. It sounded like the team wanted to go one way or the other to make the trade, that being the Timberwolves. And then they didn't bite. The Bucks did not bite at what was being offered up, essentially Jaylen Brown and a couple of picks from Brad Stevens. Do you think that maybe the Celtics have overestimated Jaylen Brown's value in the eyes of other teams?
I mean, it's possible. I've talked to people around the league, and his value is supposedly still very high. So I've seen a lot of people in Boston say, well, if his value is so high, then why haven't they traded him yet? It doesn't mean that there aren't good packages out there that would bring back value. It just means that there's not a package that's been worth pulling the trigger for yet, right? It's possible they're considering various things. The Celtics keep things very close to the vest, so I wouldn't be, you know, it could be this hour where all of a sudden he gets traded for a haul, and we're all kind of wondering why we had that conversation. But the return on LaMelo Ball, in my eyes, was pretty weak. It's effectively Naz Reid and a first-round pick and a couple of pick swaps that might actually not pan out, because I don't know that Minnesota is going to be a worse team than Charlotte those years, right? So it's effectively a first-round pick and Naz Reid, who is a high-level role player, but somebody who's been coming off the bench, right? So it's very possible that Boston would have scoffed at that return and wanted much more than that for Jaylen. I would be surprised if they would have accepted that return. So I know I've seen the reporting of, like, they chose the LaMelo package over Jaylen, but yeah, we have no reason to think it's for the same value. And I do know that his value is much higher now than it was a year ago at this time. Like, many people I've spoken to have said, you know, teams were very impressed by what he was able to do during this past season without Jason Tatum as the number one guy, the kinds of performances he had. And because it ended so sour, I think a lot of people, even locally, have forgotten what that year looked like. and how effective he was and how many big-time performances he had. But because at the end of the day, all that matters is the playoffs in Boston, right? Like, we don't care about January, but teams were impressed with how he played. So I'd be surprised if they do move him if it's for a weak return.
Noah, there's been a lot made about Jason Tatum and his influence or maybe impact on all of these proceedings. Any word on Joe Mazzulla and if he's had any sort of input on these potential trade packages or anything like that? Is he part of this? Is he someone that they're sort of going to get input on?
Yeah, I mean, Joe and Brad have a very close relationship, and they have for a long time. It's a unique dynamic because obviously he was one of Brad's assistant coaches, and so they have, it kind of goes all the way back to that. And I know that they've been in regular communication. I know that they've both been in the building, and it's like any decision that the Celtics make is not made in a vacuum, right? Like, they've committed to Joe long term, and I think that he is somebody that is very much a decision maker, just like Brad. It's obviously he's not the ultimate guy that's pulling the trigger. So I'm not sure exactly where he kind of lands on all of this, but I will say the Jason Tatum stuff is interesting because it would just be so out of line or out of left field for him to get publicly involved in this sort of thing. Like, I'm not sure. And I know that they're actually both, I think, in the same city in Europe right now, Jason and Jalen. I have no idea if they've had conversations or not, but like, I've seen the pressure of like, oh, why isn't he tweeting or why isn't he speaking out? When have we ever seen anything like that? And especially for somebody like Jason Tatum, who is so buttoned up and so PR trained and never really says things like that. Like, if there is a back and forth right now between Brad Stevens and Jalen and an open line of communication, and they're trying to figure out what's best and where both parties want to go, for Tatum to get publicly involved would be like pretty unprecedented. So I'm not sure why that became like a big theme and critique both in Boston and nationally around kind of how he should behave right now.
How would you characterize their relationship then?
Tatum and Browns?
Yeah.
I think highly professional. Like, you know, there's an outside view of people want them to be really close friends. I've never gotten the sense that they're really close friends. But they've been kind of co-leaders of this franchise for a long time. And getting to the top of the mountain in 2024 was very rewarding, I think, for both of them because they did it with each other. And up until this point, they have committed, they've both spoken about this publicly, privately, like whenever they've hit a crossroad in the road, they've looked at each other and said, you know, do you still want to be here? Do I still want to be here? We both want to keep doing this, right? That doesn't mean that can't change at some point, and maybe this is the summer where that does change. But to date, I think they just very much respect each other. They push each other to be better. But they're not best friends, right? And I think that if it would be, like, if Tatum and White were the two co-stars, like, those guys have obviously have more of, like, a public-facing friendship, I think people's questions around this stuff would be absolved.
Well, Noah, your opinion has completely contradicted the insider named Robot Dave on Twitter, who said that they do not get along at all. So I actually was sent that, and I was like, hang on, did anybody check the name of the person who tweeted this out? It's at Robot Dave. I don't think that person with, I think, maybe 300 followers is someone I should trust, Noah.
Yeah, and again, it's like, I'm not trying to sell this vision of, like, oh, these two guys. Like, I see sometimes the fans have these Twitter edits, and they're like, these two guys love each other so much, they're best friends, like, you could never separate them. I think they're two guys that have been competitive over the years. Like, they played, they're the same age, same position. Like, there are some natural factors that have made this dynamic so, you know, hot button for the national media. But yeah, again, I've been around them for the last few years. I've never gotten the sense that there's like a problem there. And I've never heard that from anybody else that there's a problem there. There are a lot of egos in this business, right? There's a lot of people a lot of relationships that sour at times and people that snap at each other and all that. And this to me just feels like a tension point that's not really there that we've just put a lot of time and energy into.
Well, Noah, it looks like you're going to be on Twitch soon. Sitting in...
That's for sure.
T-minus 45
minutes.
Changed
my plans.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Noah, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. You can follow her at @NoahDalZell. Did I spell that correct, Noah?
Yeah, that's correct. Thanks so much.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. That comes from somebody with the last name, certainly. So I got to know how to spell last names correctly. She also writes for the Celtics blog and the You Got Boston podcast. Thank you, Noah, for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Oh, Twitch. He's going to Twitch, and he's going to talk about Jason. How great would it be if he went on Twitch, and it opens up, and you click, and the first face you see Jason Tatum.
And Whale.
That was huge.
And Whale.
Yeah.
And
how is Wale? Should I be in the know?
Wale, oh, he's good. Yeah.
Is very, very good rapper.
Yeah.
Is he going to rap on stream tonight?
My cousin directed a Wale video. Wow. Hey, how about that?
Wow.
3 degrees of awesome. So I kind of know
which one.
I know.
Right.
You know?
Payne, the one who's Up and Vanished. He did that whole podcast thing.
Cool.
All right. 617-779-7937. We will take your calls on all things Jaylen Brown and Whale right after this.
I'm somewhat grateful because I get to see some negativity that I didn't want, but that just gives more fuel to the fire. I get to see some, you know, comments or takes that I didn't even care to see, but it just gives me more fuel to the fire. So all the people that doubted me, that want me to do this or want me gone or whatever, you turned me into a monster.
High noon! Jones and Keith here on WEEI. It's been a while. But it is time for Pure Hoops.
Look who's back
with Terp.
It is an honor to be back. It has been a while.
It has been
missed
too long.
You guys.
Way too long. Terp's move on to and better things.
No, I've seen.
What are you
it.
Doing?
I
saw a Terp recently.
You did?
Yeah. You were out.
I was right in your chair.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I saw Terp recently. It's been a while since we did Pure Hoops, all three of us.
Listen, I'm a family man. You know, sometimes you gotta be a father, and you gotta take the day off
of
work.
Is that what you were doing when you were with? The reunion?
My buddies that was from 20 years ago, my college friends.
That was some good parenting.
Yeah, it was.
Nice, I like it. All right, Terp, you know the question. Giannis is now with the Miami Heat. The Celtics clearly wanted Giannis. The Bucks preferred Miami's offer, I guess, at least Jimmy Haslam preferred the offer. Your thoughts on what went down last night?
I mean, this is kind of worst case scenario for the Celtics, right? Like, you go all in on Giannis, and now this is out that you were shopping Jaylen Brown. And obviously, he's been in these discussions before, Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard, but this is different, right? Since then, he's won a championship. He was the finals MVP, had a career best year last year, finished sixth in MVP voting, and now you're trying to trade him. It is a little bit different now. But I do refuse to believe that the front office and Brad Stevens didn't have a backup plan. Whether or not that is another trade or conversations behind the scenes where Jaylen has been aware of their thought process, something is there. This isn't like we're going to strike out and just go from there. Like, there were some sort of backup plans, and we'll see what those are.
Should they have thrown in Ugo Gonzalez and or Baylor Shireman or whatever else it would have taken to get the deal done?
If it was just Ugo, I think, first of all, I think a lot of people were looking at this. It was like Jaylen and picks, and that's really easy to get behind. But when you start adding in all the other young cat, like all the other draft capital and stuff, like, I don't know if they necessarily had to. I don't think they had to get that desperate. Now,
okay, but so I agree. I don't think they had to.
They probably
either.
Should know.
I think Jaylen is a better offer. But let's say, because you just called it a worst case scenario to not get Giannis
to get this out. More so, this getting out like right after.
Okay, well, now it's out, and you know it's out. So, like, should they have thrown those guys into the deal?
I probably would have. It's Giannis, man. Like, I think people are forgetting just how good Giannis is.
I think there is a lot of that. I also don't think there's a better trade that you can make if you have to, and maybe you feel like you have to trade Jaylen Brown now. You're not doing better than Giannis. You know, we just did our tiers, and you know, the only guys above Giannis are Jokic, SGA, Wemby, and then depending on how you rank them, because they're on the same tier, Tatum, Luka, Brunson. You're not getting any of those guys. You're not getting anywhere close to any of those guys. Even the tier below that, none of those guys are going to get traded. Maybe Kawhi Leonard does, but that's a different conversation. He's a little bit older and everything else.
Also,
so,
where does he rank on that? Like, it's a tier, it's not a ranking. But
no,
if it was
question.
A ranking last
Giannis?
Year, if had he played more, had he not been plagued with the leg injuries?
I think he's still a top five player.
I would agree.
Yeah.
The last 7 years, he was top four in MVP and first team All-NBA. Like, he is that good. He's one of three players to win, like, a finals MVP, a defensive player of the year. All that was like Jordan, Elijah Wan. Like, he is that good.
How do you think they would have fit? Because my issue isn't that Giannis isn't talented. Of course he's talented. Mm-hmm. And he might be a top 5-6 player in the NBA even today. And I have questions about his health and his age and his motivation. How would he have fit with Tatum?
I think it would have fit great. I really do. And I think that would open up like more shots for Jason Tatum. Obviously, like, there was this misconception that Giannis wouldn't have fit in the Missoula Ball system, which is just totally wrong because it feeds off driving kick and creating opportunities and creating advantages.
He wouldn't fit if the offense runs through Tatum.
No, I think it would have looked kind of similar to the way it does now.
You can't go stick him out on a wing or in a corner.
A big question with that, too, would have been what they did with the center, because, like, you could not put Kata on with Giannis. Like, it would just been way too clogged up in the paint. Like, you would have needed to go out and get a stretch five, which is where I was looking at it. It was like, okay, if the Celtics were, when there were the hypotheticals of the Celtics holding on to Jaylen and making an offer for Giannis and acquiring Giannis, that was where I would have looked at it. I was like, okay, if you do have all three, then do you flip Jaylen and get like a true stretch five? Like, because you would have needed that. It wouldn't have worked with Kata.
I think it would have been. I ended up, by the end of it, which is funny because then it doesn't happen. But I was like really talking myself into it, and I was like, all right, for the last four seasons, Giannis led the league in 2-point attempts per game. So, like, completely different than what we've been seeing with the Celtics and with Mazzulla. And so, even though Jaylen Brown isn't a guy that just launches a lot of threes, going to Giannis and allowing Giannis to sort of drive, you'd still have threes, right? But you'd have wide open looks. I feel like Sam Hauser and Peyton Pritchard could just stand wherever they want and launch threes because there'd be guys, there'd be two guys on Giannis, there'd be two guys on Tatum, and it'd be a nightmare. And we were going over this before, too. I think just getting out of the Eastern Conference now, so many of these teams, sneaky, do have big men. You thought the big men were kind of leaving the NBA, but Karl-Anthony Towns, Joel Embiid, Evan Mobley, like you're probably going to have to go through one, two, or three of those guys to then face Wembanyama or Chet Holmgren or Jokic. So it's like, wait a minute. Giannis might even have more value than we were letting on.
I looked at the DraftKings odds today for winner Eastern Conference winner next year.
I don't get
it's the Celtics.
I don't understand.
The Celtics are the
Celtics
favorite
over
to win the
Knicks,
East.
And then Miami is third at like plus exactly.
That's people trying to get like a sucker's bet there. They completely drained the talent on that team. Like yeah, they got to cut Bam. And
I didn't think they had talent.
Yeah, they didn't have. That's what took this thing so long.
But like
yeah.
The Celtics shouldn't be the favorite right now.
No. Do you think that's more about like the recent historical trends where like teams don't go back to win the conference back-to-back?
We assumed before this trade fell through that Giannis was baked in, and that's why the Celtics were favored over the Knicks.
But the Celtics
and I agree, they should
be the year after they won. The Thunder were the favorite the year after they won. Now neither of them did, but I'm just saying like the odds makers
were like,
and
the Knicks are essentially running it back. Like
yes.
The only person they might lose is Mitchell Robinson. Right. That's not like no.
No,
loss,
but like,
they are still far and away the best team in the East.
Yeah, that's surprising.
The Celtics have a lot of work to do here, and like they have ways to do it.
What can they do?
Well, that's where it comes into like the Jaylen Brown discussion. Like, what were the conversations like? What is he aware of? Was he fine with either outcome? Was he fine with that? Like,
let's just back it up for a second. Do you think he gets dealt today?
I don't see the rush for it. Honestly, like unless you're moving up further
well,
in the draft.
If they already had a plan. If they already had
a plan,
then
possibly, yeah.
I mean, you think they have a plan. They wouldn't just go into Giannis blind. So if they have a plan, they can just pivot to their
plan
right?
B, yeah. You would imagine it was definitely there's definitely something there. Whether again that was conversations with Jaylen where he was aware that this is a very specific thing and he understood that it's part of the business. But do we really think that was Jaylen? Like just knowing how he operates and knowing the chip that he has on his shoulder, was he okay with that? Not to mention he doesn't like Giannis, so you're trying to trade him for a guy that
Giannis.
He doesn't like. Like I don't know if that adds into it, but
good
like
point.
I don't know, like. There's clearly going to be frustration. Now, how does Brad Stevens mend that fence? That's the question. And is it untenable? Like, maybe it is.
I think he's done
with it.
I think that it is now just because enough has changed, and now he's in another trade rumor again very publicly, and now he's it doesn't happen. But then some of these comments, like I think it was Brian Windhorst being like, well, now the Celtics are like all ears on all these trade offers, and it's like best offer wins for Jaylen Brown. You're like, that's different.
I wouldn't be
that wasn't
rush
normally what
trade.
It is.
I wouldn't. Like, let the good offers come. And if you, if
but
the
they
Celtics,
I wouldn't either.
They might be.
They might be.
They might be like, oh, boy.
If this was truly a specific thing for Giannis, it was just Giannis they wanted, prove it. Give Jaylen Brown the extension this summer, and there you go. You lock him in. You give him. It's going to be close to $70 million towards the end of his contract.
Yeah,
now, do they think it's worth it? That's another question. But if it was truly a specific thing.
This is a good point.
If it was truly a specific to Giannis thing,
you can make it up to him, or you can like double down on your like disrespect for him.
He's not going to turn down two years for $140 million. He's not. So if you really believe in him that you can win with this core and that was specific to Giannis, extend him.
No, but for everyone who says you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube and Jaylen will not play here, well, dangle that extension in front of him.
That's the way to do it.
That is a way to talk him
into
it.
That's
a good point.
The flip side is also true.
If you don't, then
Jaylen's like, you've insulted me three ways.
You apparently value me less than Baylor Shireman, Hugo Gonzalez. You won't hand me extension. You wanted to trade me for Giannis, who I hate. So look, that's another way that could go for sure.
That's eligible in July. So we could get some clarity on that real soon.
What other trades, if any, interest you for Jaylen Brown? Like, what other names? We've talked a lot of Trey Murphy.
Yeah, that's the big one, I think, that people are looking at. But what's
a big downgrade, isn't it, from Jaylen Brown?
I mean, Trey Murphy's a great player, and I also think he could be a product of, like,
he's not top 26 and 26,
well,
I'll tell you that.
Being on a bad team works both ways, right? Because you're like, all right, you score over 20 points a game, but yes, somebody does on a bad team. Or you're like, well, if you surrounded him with a few more winning players and he was in games that mattered, maybe he'd look a little bit different. It's sort of like an unknown, though. Like, you can go somewhere and you know, like this is sort of like Jaylen Brown's thing. Like, you want to go play for a team that's not as great, then okay, you're going to be the man. So I just feel like, especially because there's like redundancy at the position, swapping out Jaylen Brown for Trey Murphy just feels like you're saving money and getting a little bit worse.
Also, if you want to put more pressure on the rim, I don't think that's the way to do it. No. I think I would keep Jaylen, who led the league in drives last year, as opposed to Trey Murphy.
Oh, you're going
to
shoot more threes, right. Especially if that's the swap.
But, like, if you feel like you need to put more pressure on the rim, Giannis obviously would have done that. He's one of the best in the league at it. But if not, Jaylen's a fine alternative. The guy led the league in drives last year, and that was one of your most efficient scores.
No, we've said this before. I mean, if you really want to change your play style, you got to get Tatum. If it's play style is the number one driver for a lot of people. It's not for me, but it is for a lot of people. Tatum's the much bigger offender of that than Jaylen Brown is. Yeah. And to your point, Trey Murphy shoots more threes than Derek White, who I'm done with. I'm done with Derek White. Because something needs to change on this team. You can't just like trade Hauser or somebody down the bottom of the roster and say that's changing it. Like, something needs to change. Trey Murphy shoots more threes than Derek White. So like that, if you're talking play style, that's not going to change anything. If it's Murphy for Jaylen, that probably leans even further on the Missoula ball.
But yeah, I get that they need to put more pressure on the rim and stuff, but you also need to change the personnel to do that. And I don't think necessarily like trading Jaylen for Trey Murphy does that.
Okay.
Like,
so let's get into this more. Some of the names that are out there. What are the Celtics going to do? What's left to do this offseason? Plus all your thoughts on the Celtics striking out on Giannis. You can dial us up 617-779-7937 for all your questions for Justin Turpin, Terp of WEEI. We will do that, Terp, in just 2 minutes. Stick around. More on the Celtics and what they're going to do this offseason, perhaps as soon as tonight, again in just 2 minutes.
It is 93.7 WEEI. Rich and Ken, Christian Arcan will be in just a moment. And we are down at Fenway Park right now before the crowd. Oh, there we go. Some Yankees gear. I see.
There we go. Waiting for the New Yorkers. Knicks fans too, probably.
Yeah.
Come on in.
Wouldn't doubt it. Well, we are at the Ford Clubhouse at Fenway Studio, brought to you by your New England Ford dealers. And employee pricing for all. You pay what we pay. Ford, the official vehicle of Major League Baseball. And that dirty water. Well, one of the biggest stories of this NFL offseason wasn't a trade. It was a scandal, one between our own Mike Vrabel and Diana Rossini, the NFL insider. And we all saw the pictures that came out. We all saw the very strange boat rental where she was pregnant and they took pictures with people. Of all the pictures that came out, the ones that made me like, how could you just be so cavalier with this relationship?
It was a bonding exercise. There's nothing wrong with that.
Sure, that you just took photos and then don't tell anyone. Then, of course, everything breaks and then this all happens. But the New York Times, who is the parent company of The Athletic, which is, of course, where Diana Rossini worked, they put out an article yesterday. And it was a pretty extensive article going through some of the new findings that they came up with that is really... It seems to me like it's a teaser for when the actual investigation that The Athletic is doing about Diana Rossini drops. Matter of fact, I don't really know what the purpose of this article was. It did have some interesting things in it, but a guy who's been on top of this entire story, and we've had him on before to talk about it, and amongst other things, is the great Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk. Mike, thanks for joining us, man. We really appreciate it.
Guys, how's it going today?
Yeah, good as always. All right, so, you know, we were just talking about this. What do you think the purpose of the New York Times coming out with this article yesterday was when it seems like we're kind of on the horizon of the actual big drop that of the investigation that The Athletic has about Diana Rossini?
I think they felt compelled to engage in some form of journalism as it relates to the biggest off-field story that the NFL has had since the Super Bowl. And my first thought when I saw it was The Athletic's report of its internal investigation must be coming soon, and they wanted to get ahead of it, and it may very well be the appetizer for what The Athletic is going to eventually publish. Whether they publish it internally, externally, doesn't matter. If they publish it internally, somebody's going to leak it. We're all going to see it at some point. And my guess is coming next week, maybe Thursday, maybe Friday, perfect midsummer bad news dump right before 4th of July.
right. Like, it's going to be Thursday afternoon. Everyone's already got off on their vacations. You know, like, you know, you got the D team that's on like ESPN the next day. So yeah, I could totally see that happening. But it is weird, wasn't it, Mike, when you're reading an article written by the parent company of the company that's doing their own investigation? It seemed very strange because, like, are they going to tell you everything? Because if they find something bad, that makes them look bad.
Well, and nobody from the Times or the Athletic would speak on the record about the situation to the New York Times. And you make a great point. That was something we wrote today. And I have found 5, 6, 7 different items within this longer article that I think are interesting. But they mention, kind of in passing with just one paragraph, the Julio Jones trade from Atlanta to Tennessee that happened in June of 2021. They don't mention that Vrabel was the head coach of the Titans at the time. And there are some interesting aspects of her reporting from right around the same time that could be used to make the argument that something fishy was going on, that there may have been an effort to help the Titans get Julio Jones. And to not mention any of that, I feel like that at some level there's a desire to ensure that no one takes a step back and says, what did the Athletic know? What should it have known about who they were hiring when they hired her in 2023? So I think that's out there too. I think there's some not so subtle CYA to avoid that question of why did the Athletic hire her in the first place? If there was evidence out there, if there were rumors out there, if whatever was out there, what kind of a vetting did they do?
Yeah, because it seemed like they played dumb in the article too, because there was a story that they mentioned that was on a podcast she was on. I think she told the story with Stu Gatz, and it was about how she got pulled over, and to get out of a ticket, she asked the officer, who's your favorite football coach? And she got him on FaceTime to get him out of a ticket. And I believe that their quote was just like, well, we're just now finding out about this because she did not ask us to go on a podcast. Once again, doesn't that also seem like everything that's going to come out is just going to make the company that's writing the article look bad? So I question how much they're actually going to release.
Yeah, what it means is they were paying attention to nothing that she was saying on any of these various platforms, or if they were, it never dawned on them that there was anything about it that seemed off base in any way. And look, it's one thing to not just pay the ticket, but leverage a relationship with a coach to try to get out of the ticket, but then to go talk about it publicly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just judgment lapse on top of judgment lapse. And yeah, maybe the Athletic knew about it and didn't think anything of it, or they're hiding behind this clause in her contract. And all those contracts have it in there. You got to ask for permission. And at the end of the day, nobody does. They just do whatever they do. But what you say is out there. Anybody that wants to know about it, wants to hear about it, can find it easily.
Well, Mike, there was a lot of nothing in there, but as you point out, there are a couple things that you do pause. Like, so she emailed the publisher of The Athletic and two senior editors at the Times to ask to make a text that she had said to a reporter off the record. That is kind of interesting that they put that in there. What do you read from that? What's that mean for the next wave?
Well, anybody who is in the media business, who is engaged in any type of reporting, who has gone to journalism school, and I didn't, but I've kind of learned over 25 years what the rules of the road are. If you just talk to a reporter, anything you say is on the record. You've got to say off the record, and they have to agree to it before anything you say is off the record. And there have been people within the NFL ecosystem that have gotten in trouble with that, whether they knew or should have known better. Sean Payton a few years ago, if you remember, he said a lot of stuff about the Broncos and former coach Nathaniel Hackett to Jarrett Bell of USA Today, and it made a big uproar. And the reality is he just forgot to say off the record before he talked to Jarrett Bell. He intended it to be off the record, but somebody who's been doing it for as long as Payton has should know to say this is off the record. And Russini should have known, or did know, that you have to say off the record. You don't just start responding to a reporter who's asking you for an interview and then at the end of the text message try to say don't use any of this in your story. So that was just kind of odd. And we've seen this, you know, this effort to kind of go around and go over people's heads and complain to people. And I mean, there's a level of aggressiveness that comes through that makes me wonder what's going to happen if and when the Athletic releases its report. Is there going to be something in there that causes her to take some sort of action against the Athletic? I think that's part of what the Times Company, the Athletic, and the New York Times are trying to balance here.
Oh, wow. So you think that she, like, from what comes out of this, she could probably try to, like, sue them for, like, what would she sue them for? I mean, because obviously they're probably not going to release anything unless it's well-researched. I got to think of the New York Times. They've been through things like this before.
Well, a defamation of character case would be very difficult for any public figure to make because the standard is much higher than what it would be for someone who isn't a public figure. But when you consider that all she's said so far, other than what she told the reporter before she tried to take it off the record, is that nothing happened. There's nothing to see here. This is all something that the media made up that is unmoored from the facts. That was from her resignation letter, and she hasn't said anything since then. So if she insists that there was nothing there, and these reports and these comments and whatever the Athletic may find that she did, however they characterize it, nothing stops her from doing it. It may go nowhere, but nothing stops her from doing it.
What do you believe Diana Rossini's next move is?
I think she's going to resurface somewhere as a podcaster, a radio host, an opinion maker. And I think there will be an element of reporting that maybe trickles into what she does, even though she won't be a reporter. There's plenty of radio hosts who quote-unquote know people and who quote-unquote hear things and share them. And, you know, if it's right, hey, I'm right. And if it's wrong, oh, it's just what I was hearing from somebody I know. So if she's able to maintain a network of people who talk to her, she'll be able to weave some reporting into whatever it is she does. But I suspect at some point, and I don't know where it will be, but at some point, at the right time, she'll resurface with, even if it's her own podcast, that she starts from her house. I don't think she's going to go away forever. We know, you know, no matter how, and I'm not trying to say this is worse than that or that's worse than this, but for pretty much anything, once enough time passes, everybody forgets about it and moves on, and people who go away for a while, they come back, and it's like it never happened.
Do you think if she, because I was thinking at first that she'd have to address this at some point, like she would have to break the dam, like her first big appearance, she would have to address it. But then I was thinking, she's paid off. She doesn't have to address it. She can just kind of move on. Do you think that that's realistic, that potentially she could be paid to not say anything?
Well, I think that there's always a chance that she's going to agree to sit down with someone and do an interview. As long as the interest lingers to interview her, to get her story, that possibility is going to be out there. And one of the things I've been saying about the Patriots week one game at Seattle, Wednesday, September 9, Tuesday night, September 8, would be the perfect time for her to sit down with Oprah or whoever and tell her story. I don't know that anyone's going to care by September, but look, here we are 2.5 months removed from it, and it's still a big deal. So I've thought at some point that's one of her options, to tell her story, whatever her story may be. Nobody knows what her story is because she's hardly said anything about it. That may be her way to kind of get back into the mix, depending upon how compelling the story is, depending upon whether or not it generates any sympathy or people understand her side of it. Again, we're just guessing because we have no idea what she would say if she would do an interview like that. But to me, before the Times report came out, I thought there were two ways that this story could get more oxygen. One, the Athletic's report of its internal investigation, and two, when she tells her story, wherever she tells her story, however she tells her story.
Were you surprised, Mike, that the Patriots did get that opening game?
Yes and no. I know the NFL's position is it was too hard to resist having a Super Bowl rematch right out of the gates, but they've had Super Bowl rematches before that weren't right out of the gates. It's only the third time it's ever happened, dating all the way back to after the Vikings and the Chiefs played in Super Bowl IV. So it was surprising. I don't know that the average football fan has the appetite to tune back in for the first game that they'll watch after the Super Bowl and see the same thing that they saw from Santa Clara, because that's the reality. And we always remind ourselves of this at NBC since we have the first game every year. There's a lot of people who are going to tune into that game on Wednesday, September 9, who have been paying attention to not very much at all. And I don't know how many of those people are going to be thrilled. Now, I still think there's a chance the Patriots could win the game, but the fact that the Super Bowl itself just felt like one of those old 70s-style suffocation Super Bowls, yeah, it's easy to make the argument that there are more compelling opponents on Seattle's home schedule.
Mike, there was something in this article that I want to ask you about. I totally forgot about it because I don't know how odd this is. And there was a, God, I wish I had the article in front of me on how they worded it, but it was something along the lines of when Vrabel had was done with the Titans, that she was basically someone helping guide his career. Like she was a helper, maybe keeping him in contact with the powers that be. It almost sounded like she was acting somewhat as like a mini agent for him. Do you have this right? Oh, you have it right here.
An unofficial advisor.
Yeah, that's what it was, like an unofficial advisor to Mike Vrabel. Does that happen with insiders, or is this something completely out of bounds?
One of the realities of this entire situation, and I know that the people who are quote-unquote insiders get nervous about this, it does expose a lot about how that business works. And I've written about it. I've spoken about it. When we see insiders breaking transactional news when someone signs a contract, it happens all the time now. An agent will send out a text message to multiple people at the same time, and then it's a race to see who can be the first one to copy it, paste it, and post it on Twitter. It happened yesterday with Brendan Strange's contract, because I don't try to get those anymore because, number one, my audience doesn't care that that someone else had it before this other person.
But right, second, right.
I don't want to play this game where I've got to, in order to be at the front of the line, I've got to make sure I name the agents and put the Twitter handle of the firm. And I got the text yesterday on Brendan Strange, and I sent it to my staff, and I said, you watch and see how many people tweet exactly what was texted, and at least two of them did.
Yeah. So it was just, that was a weird thing in that article. I didn't really understand what they meant by that, that they were, you know, like she was helping him out that way. It was kind of wild how many Titans games she covered as a national reporter. Like, it was like half a season, essentially, that was down there. It's like, now that you see all this stuff, it's like, how many people must have known, right? I mean, I don't know how you can do what they did and people around you just not know what was going on.
And I think this is the core issue as it relates to the New York Times and The Athletic. The Times has a very high bar when it comes to journalistic standards. But I think when you're hiring someone who's covering the NFL in that insider role, you just want the information. There are certain things you don't care about if you're the producer, if you're the editor, if you're the network. And you could argue that if this story had emerged while she was working for any other company, and I'm not going to name any, I'm just saying anyone other than the New York Times, where that bar is lower, maybe they just kind of turn a blind eye to it, because at the end of the day, it's effective. It works. It gets you news. That's why they're there. And I think there's plenty of people in management positions that don't care how they get it, as long as they get it.
Yeah, exactly. And the one thing that's going to get them, I think, in the most trouble is if they find out that there was some sort of way that the trade market was manipulated because of her relationship. Like, that Julio Jones thing is interesting. I mean, that truly could have, I mean, and we don't even know what else there could be. I mean, that's like the first one that you see, and obviously the most obvious example. But if there comes out proof that, you know, their relationship manipulated that, the Times could be in legitimate trouble.
Well, and I know a lot of Eagles fans were upset about the perception that there was reporting that potentially impacted the A.J. Brown trade to the Patriots, that maybe the Patriots got better terms because of some of the reporting. So I would expect that The Athletic is taking a close look at everything she has reported that relates directly or indirectly to Mike Vrabel during the 3 years that she worked for The Athletic. I don't know that ESPN is doing anything. I reached out to them once we saw the photos that the New York Post published right before the draft of Vrabel and Russini at a bar in New York City, which I think those photos were a lot more we know what we see here than the original photos that came out. I reached out to ESPN to see if they were doing anything, and they aren't saying anything about this. I think from their perspective, they don't want to dredge up any of this, but you raise fair questions. What do people know? When did they know it? And ultimately, do they care? If there was anything going on that maybe wasn't something that satisfies strict journalism standards, do they really care, or do they care about getting these stories before anyone else does?
Well, we will find out when the investigation is released at 5 p.m. on July 3rd. Right when everyone...
That'd be too obvious, though, right? I think it's going to be Thursday, because Friday would be too obvious. And I could see The Athletic talking themselves into doing it Wednesday, because Thursday would be obvious that you were trying to avoid Friday. So maybe it's going to be Wednesday, July 1st.
I like it. Place your bets. We'll see who's the closest. All right. Well, great stuff, Mike Flory. We love having you on. ProFootballTalk.com. And obviously all over the interwebs. Thanks for coming on, Mike. We appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, guys.
All right, see you, man. Yeah, that article was interesting, but it just seems like they're putting stuff, they're getting you ready for
phase one.
Yep, this is phase one. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like. It felt like, just get ready, here we go. I also think they tried to put in that thing, she didn't want us to publish this her text to us, but we're going to publish it anyway to try to make it sound like we're going to be real tough on her when we release this. They're tattling on their own company. I don't know how
can you not get the editors to comment?
I mean, right. It's like the New York Times cannot get a comment from the New York Times on this article. It was really freaking weird. All right, we have to break, but we'll be back in 2 minutes. Christian Arcanis here.
Red Sox front office report is brought to you by Shaw's and Star Market, official supermarket of the Red Sox Radio Network, by findmassmoney.gov, and by John Sewer and Drain Cleaning, the name to know when your drains don't flow. We are at the Parrot in Hull, and folks, we are joined now by the chief baseball officer of the Boston Red Sox, Craig Breslow. Craig, good morning, Craig.
Good morning. How are you doing?
These people, we got people here in Hall, Craig. Say hello to the people in Hall.
How's everybody doing this morning?
They're doing good. Uh-huh. We're going to try to control these people, Craig. I'm sure you're feeling good this morning after starting this Yankee series off with a win last night.
Well, the morning after a win is always better than after a loss, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't hide how disappointing the season has been to date.
You said Monday to Tim Healy that you still think the ship can be righted. We had Sam Kennedy doing this a couple weeks ago on this show and said, you know, we have a couple weeks here before we need to pivot, which would be now. Is there a disconnect between you guys or where are you on kind of the philosophy going forward here?
No, there's no disconnect. Sam and I are talking every day or multiple times a day. And we're constantly assessing where we are, both in terms of what's happening, you know, at Fenway Park and with our team on the field, and then what's happening around us. But we have to be realistic about where we are. And it's true that we can believe in the roster that we have. We can believe in our players and know that we're capable of playing better baseball, and also that we're not where we expected to be. That's incredibly frustrating and disappointing, and we're going to have to be realistic about what is best for the organization.
But I mean, in order for the ship to be righted, you really have to win a whole bunch of baseball games here. Are you honestly believing that this team can do that at this point?
Yes, and you're exactly right. We have to win a lot of baseball games, and we don't have a ton of time to do it. I believe that we're capable of doing it. It's going to require more consistent play on the field. But I see no reason that with the pitching that we have, you know, with the consistency of the starting pitching, with the strength of the back end of the bullpen, that we, you know, can't put ourselves in a position where we do win those games, but we got to go out and do it. That's the reality of, you know, approaching July, being in last place in the division, not having won as many games as we thought we were going to heading into this point.
I mean, I feel like I'm more likely to go on a run than this team is, Craig.
Oh, jeez.
not a runner.
I haven't seen you throw a pitch or take a swing.
Oh, God.
How about a couple injury situations here just for update perspective. What's going on with Roman Anthony? I know Chad Tracy said the other day, still can't swing a bat. Like, what's the update there?
Yeah, not much to report, unfortunately, in terms of change. Roman's, you know, working hard to get back as soon as he can, but we're just not seeing progress as quickly as we would hope. He is getting better. He gets a little bit better every day. It's just been a very long process for him.
Craig, why is this team almost identical with two different managers? One was 7 games under. Chad Tracy, I believe, is 6 games under. If the manager was the problem, why are they the same?
I mean, our performance has not been what we would have hoped, and ultimately that the accountability for that falls on me. But I also think that, you know, we've consistently pitched really well over the last 2 months or so. We've seen, you know, some guys put together more consistent at bats. We've seen guys continue to perform. Ultimately, where we're falling short, and I will be the first person to acknowledge that and own it, is we're not winning baseball games.
But I would say the accountability actually fell on Cora. He's out of a job, and you're here, so how is that the case?
I'm not totally sure I follow the question. You know, every time I'm faced with a difficult decision, I do what I believe to be best for the organization. I will continue to do that for as long as I have this position. And, you know, ultimately it's my responsibility to do everything that I possibly can to put a team on the field, you know, that meets the expectations of our fan base, meets the expectation of the organization, and that's one that can compete for World Series championships.
Craig, when you look at this roster, do you feel like you did everything in your power to put together the best roster leading up until this season?
You know, I think we improved our roster relative to the team that finished the season in 2025, but ultimately, again, you know, this comes down to what happens on the field. This is the big leagues, and you know, we're measured by the success that we have on the field, and right now we're falling short. So, you know, we can believe in the players, we can believe in the roster, but ultimately we have to, you know, we have to look back at the decisions that we made and question where we might have been able to do things better.
We talked a lot on the show, and we're not there, so we just don't know. So we always kind of speculate. Be great to hear about Kyle Boddy leaving and how involved he was. Is there a change when it comes inside the organization? How much you are going to or do rely on Driveline?
Sure. So Kyle was a consultant for the last 2 years. His responsibilities within the organization had diminished over time. There was another opportunity that he wanted to pursue, and you know, it made sense for him to do that based on the work that he was doing here versus what he had in front of him. You know, I think if I were to talk about how he contributed over the last year or so, he worked with members of our, what we call baseball sciences, but it's the sports science and biomechanics and that department, just given the exposure that he has to some of the newest technology that players use to train. And so he was able to contribute in that space.
Craig, how would you describe the team's fundamental inability to understand the basics of baseball? Like, with two outs, you're turning a double play. You're throwing to the wrong cutoff man. Like, it just has, even aesthetically, it's been a tough watch. Why is that? Why would you say that that's happening on a big league club?
Yeah, I think some of those, I'll call them, you know, mental lapses, they come when there's frustration around performance, when guys are putting pressure on themselves and maybe trying to do a little bit too much or focused on the next thing instead of the thing that's directly in front of them. You know, and we've made some changes to the way that we approach teaching the fundamentals of baseball throughout the organization to address those types of things. You know, things like how to be the best base running team we possibly can, how to have situational awareness, and you know, really teach gameplay so that when guys get to the big leagues, you know, no matter how much pressure they feel, no matter what their performance is on the other side of the ball, they're able to handle those things.
Are you currently actively engaging when it comes to talking to other teams about deals that they might want to make when it comes to players on this team?
This is the time of year where a lot of those conversations start taking place. You know, they tend to be pretty exploratory in nature at this point, but we've been having conversations throughout the season looking at what we can do to improve our outlook. You know, today is no different.
Craig, when you talk about little things, you know, basic errors, lack of focus, and the team not playing as well as they are, how much, or do you look at possibly that some guys might be checked out? And if so, how do you make sure you get those guys not to just be looking at, all right, when is this season going to be over?
Yeah, I would push back strongly on the notion that guys are checked out. I actually think the opposite is what's happening. If you spend any time in the clubhouse with these guys, they're focused on preparing for the game. They're working incredibly hard. They're talking about baseball. They are the furthest thing from checked out. Actually, in the clubhouse, the focus is on what they can do to get better, to prepare, and to win that night's game. And that's the reality when you walk in.
Do you talk to John Henry about your own job? There was a story yesterday by Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic that said after Cora, you were next. I don't know how you would handle that internally when you see something like that in the newspaper and on The Athletic.
I don't have conversations with John about my job. My focus is on doing the things that I was brought in here to do, things like build a strong internal pitching development pipeline to try and work through the defensive struggles that we've had, where we led baseball in errors for 3 or 4 years straight, to modernize the front office and make sure that we can compete with 29 other teams and doing everything that we can to put our players in a position to win Major League Baseball games.
We were talking a lot yesterday about some of the younger guys, Marcelo Meyer, Roman's injured, but Christian Campbell. You were just talking about kind of your role and kind of overseeing the whole organization. Do you feel like the organization has done the best that it can do with those young guys to get them ready for where the team needs them to be up here at this point?
I think we're doing everything that we can to prepare these guys. I think Boston is a unique market and it presents unique challenges. We have to be aware of that. But while we think that we're doing everything we can to prepare these guys, we also have to look at, how the transition is going for players and ask questions about what we might be missing. We talk to our players, especially players that are going through that transition, and look for feedback around where they think that they were well prepared and where they think that we can do a better job. I think both of those things can be true, that we are focused on doing everything we possibly can. And also, we've got to keep asking questions about how we can do better.
Craig, I remember when I played in the NFL, it was a long time ago. We as a team, and I know they do it a lot of sports, would give ourselves like mid-season grades on what we were doing, what we could be doing better. When you look at your team, you're almost through the halfway point of the season. What would you grade yourself and your team, and where do you think you can get better and maybe potentially changing some of those grades?
Sure. I think given where we are in the standings, given the record as we sit here on June 26th, we can't give ourselves high marks overall. I can't give myself a high mark. That doesn't mean that we aren't doing some things particularly well, though. We talked all offseason about pitching being the strength of this team. And over the last 2 months, I think we've really seen that. We've gotten consistently strong starting pitching. The back end of the bullpen, despite maybe a couple blips here recently, has been able to lock down wins for us. Our infield defense, outfield defense have been consistently excellent. And I know a lot has been made, and I think fairly, of the inconsistency to our offense. And so as we think about what the second half can bring, we need to preserve the things that we do well. We need to make sure that we're getting consistent starting pitching, which keeps us in games every night. And we need to score more runs. And we're going to score more runs by having consistently quality at-bats, understanding what the strengths are of each individual hitter and how they can go out and use those skills to contribute to runs. And I think that will include things like, blocking in when we have runners in scoring position, having a two-strike approach to battle and put the ball in play, and identifying the pitches in an at-bat before we get to two strikes where we can get our best swings off and try to do some damage.
Craig, has there sort of an organizational sit-down where you'll decide whether you're going in one way or the other? And who is a part of those negotiations or those conversations within the walls of Fenway Park in terms of the trade deadline?
Yeah. Sure. I think the conversations are pretty regular and fluid, and we're constantly assessing where we are relative to the rest of the league. But, you know, in terms of a direction, I will make a recommendation, the one that I think is best for the organization, and sit down with Sam, John, Tom, Mike Gordon, Theo, and kind of state the case for why I think one direction is the right one for us.
Well, where you are with regard to the rest of the league, unfortunately, is last. But listen, things can change. I think that's your message today, right?
Well, I think things can change. We've seen that things can change. I think more than that, though, is, you know, we've got a group of players and coaches that are committed to doing what we can to give ourselves a chance for that to change. And if you walk through the clubhouse, if you walk through the coach's room, that's what you see. It's guys who feel like it's an honor and a privilege to put on a Red Sox uniform, who want to go out and compete at a level that that makes the fan base proud. And that's something that I share with them.
All right. Appreciate you taking the time. That is Craig Breslow, the chief baseball officer of the Boston Red Sox. You can't hear it. You can't hear it, but they're cheering for you. It sounds.
They're cheering.
Craig, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
You got it. Take care.
All right. There you go. There he is. That's Craig Breslow. You people.
Guys are brutal.
You people are cruel.
Can I tell you, if they fire him today, that was evil having him do that interview.
Yeah, well, they're not going to fire him.
Oh,
I don't think
he doesn't talk to John Henry about his job. That is a bad sign, Bubba.
I think he's here at least through the season.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I would think.
I really do.
If they do fire him, it'll be after the season.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Who was the guy that got fired right after he was on with us?
Alex Cora.
No. Oh, yeah. I mean, in the front office. That's Wiggy. Another notch in your belt.
Who are you talking about?
It was a couple years ago. He was a GM, not Hoyer, Jed Hoyer. It was a different guy. There was a guy that was...
Brian O'Halloran?
No, it was...
Brian O'Halloran's still there, I think.
Right. What sport are you talking about?
It was the Red Sox front office. It was like the same day that he was on with us. He got fired. We'll figure it out.
All right. We will be back in 2 minutes with Hill Notes from Hall at the Parrot on a Roadshow Friday on WEEI.
Jones and Keefe here on WEEI. We got Brad Foe back with us. Extended Brad Foe here today.
Yay. Yay, baseball.
Yeah. We were just, in light of the Red Sox loss yesterday in Colorado, which may or may not have been their worst loss of the year. I'd argue Monday, but whatever. We're picking at a dead carcass right now. Marcelo Meyer took the heat for it yesterday, blamed himself. Horrible error. He's been pretty lousy defensively at shortstop. I wanted to see it. He hasn't been great there. He's still not really hitting, although he is starting to hit lefties a bit, if we want to be fair. Keith asked this earlier, is it time to start having a Marcelo Meyer conversation and adjust our expectations?
See, I think this is a microcosm of the problem of this roster, which is Marcelo Meyer, if you stuck him at second base, like this would be the ideal situation for me for this year for Marcelo Meyer. Even though everyone wants him a fourth pick in the draft in 2021, he should be a star by now, blah, blah, blah. But coming in this year, if you had, say, a Romy Gonzalez, and you were platooning him in at second base with Marcelo Meyer, and you had a healthy Trevor Story, okay, like, that's what you should do. But in terms of running out Marcelo Meyer and having him play shortstop, having him to adjust, and what I'm saying is that the good teams allow guys like this to sort of figure it themselves out at the bottom of the lineup. Dustin Pedroia started 2007. I'm not comparing him to Dustin Pedroia, but he started his rookie of the year season hitting ninth for a big chunk of that. That's not an option here. And now he's getting picked apart in terms of the off-speed stuff. Like, as you said, the shortstop hasn't really been working out for him. It's in a perfect world, but as we have found out, nothing about this season is remotely close to a perfect world.
Yeah, and that's why I think I just go back with Meyer, like, or just any top prospect like that. There are plenty of examples. You bring up Pedroia, like we were talking about Mike Trout, for God's sakes, his first year, however many games, wasn't great, got sent back down. But then, like, the next year, he was insanely good. And, like, Pedroia, the next year was insane. Or even that year, like, got really, really good rookie of the year. Next year, winning the MVP. Have there even been enough moments with Meyer where you're like, oh, that's like a flash of what he could be? I feel like I'm surprised when he gets a hit. Like, I just, I feel like he goes up there and he's almost like an automatic out. And then when you combine it with like, oh, maybe he's not as good in the field as I thought he was either. Like, I don't know, maybe it's a me problem. Maybe my expectation was too high for him. But in a roundabout way, like, is there a number of games that a guy can play, or is it just opportunities that you're like, all right, maybe it's not what we thought.
Yeah, I wouldn't go through this year and say it's not what you thought. Now, what you thought might be on a sliding scale, right? I mean, what you thought was, in fairness, we were talking about this guy for, you don't get the fourth pick in the draft a whole lot. Now, that was a lousy first round. That doesn't make a difference.
So, it's funny. I'm actually looking at it now. It is a pretty bad first round.
A terrible first round.
It was, but you remember, you know, Jackson Merrill, who's not having a good year this year, but already, he was an all-star his rookie year.
Already yeah, been he was the 27th pick in that. Like, if you had to redraft that draft, it was, I mean, Henry Davis stinks. Like, he's not good. Leiter, Jackson Job, and then Meyer. And I think a big part of that problem was that it was coming off of COVID. And, like, the scouting was all over the place. Whatever it is. I mean, it doesn't make a difference.
Okay, but, Kowser hasn't been good. Lawler's hitting 300 now, but it's taken him a while. You mentioned Merrill's been to an all-star game. Colson Montgomery was in that draft. Self Frelick has been a big leaguer now for a while.
But even so, a couple years after that draft, when they were allowed to see all these guys in the minors, he was still one of the top prospects.
Yeah,
but that's the point, is that he's always been a top prospect, starting when where he was drafted. Okay. And I think the question is, Rich, should we adjust the expectations? It's it's kind of like with Jackson Holliday, and I'm not comparing those two, but Jackson Holliday was the fourth pick in the draft. He was the top pick in the draft. He was the be all end all. When he gets called up, it was the biggest news in baseball, not even close. And then he starts out 1-for-40, and since then he hasn't been that good. He's been okay, but I think that everybody in baseball has absolutely adjusted their expectations to Jackson Holliday, and I think that we have to sort of ride out of this season and then sort of adjust it for Marcelo Meyer. I still think he's a major leaguer. I still think he's a really good defensive player, as we've seen, probably better at second base. But, you know, is he going to be a consistent top of the middle of the order guy? That's a stretch right now.
You wrote today at WEEI that why can't the Red Sox be more like the Yankees? And you went to the late 2023 season, so it's still high in bloom. This is before Breslin got here. And the Red Sox and Yankees were both right around 500 and kind of duking it out in a series. You went back to 2023. What have you found since there?
Yeah, so I remember that series because they were both basically at the same record. They were bottom of the division. Their season was over. They weren't making the wild card. It was September 12, 2023. And both teams had injuries, but the Yankees took off and they were good, and they haven't really stopped being good for the rest of the time. I think they've had 22 postseason games and the Red Sox have 3. But it just overall, in a nutshell, like that organization hasn't figured out. They've had injuries. Aaron Judge has been out all month, and they still are third in the major leagues in home runs. They still are winning the games. They have figured out. They've developed young players. They've signed the right guys. Paul Goldschmidt's having a great run here. So they have figured it out, where we're sitting here with the Red Sox, and they're in last place. I don't know if you guys know this, but they're in last place.
Dead last.
And they haven't figured it out. And all I'm saying is that I just remember that sort of being a sort of a fork in the road moment, if for nothing else, the Yankees. And they took that time, and they readjusted, because they haven't been bad a whole lot, really, in Cashman's tenure. They took that time, they adjusted, and they've had a good run ever since, and they continue that good run. And right now, I think they have the third most wins in Major League Baseball. They have it rolling, and they're going to do something at the deadline, and they're going to be probably in the World Series.
Who do you think we see first, Roman Anthony or Garrett Crochet?
Roman Anthony.
Oh, that was fast.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean,
soon?
No, I don't know, and that is – less of when I think that I know that Roman Anthony's going to be back, and more of Garrett Crochet. You know, you have to be a little bit worried here that, you know, I mean, this was, he still hasn't thrown a pitch for Chad Tracy, and that was how long ago that was. And he isn't really throwing, and when he did start throwing, he had to stop. None of this is good. Like, if you were to talk about more of a candidate for not playing this year, I would absolutely have Garrett Crochet ahead of Roman Anthony.
Hmm. Yeah, that's not ideal for sure. We were reading Mark Feinsand yesterday late in the show. He said that the Red Sox may hold on to Jarren Duran and try to trade him in the offseason. Is that because the stock is down, or do they want to let a new GM do that?
Well, I think it's the same thing we talked about with him, which is when he's awesome, when he's the player, like, oh my goodness, he's one of the best, most dynamic players in baseball, they ask for too much if any team asks about him, because they want to hold on to that guy. Say, why do we want to trade him? And if we are going to trade him, you better come with all your top prospects. And then in the next breath, we have a run like he's on right now. So you're going to trade him now, like, where you've had this up and down all year? There's no proof that whatever team is going to trade for him is going to get the good version of him. That's the problem, and they know that that's the problem with trading Jarren Duran now. And you can make the argument that they missed their ideal window, which might have been this offseason. But it's why, and I've heard you guys talk about it, it's a very polarizing thing. When he gets hot, you know, okay, you got to trade him. But the problem with this team is that you so desperately needed a player like that. Like, if you did get rid of him a month ago, you're like, oh, forget about it. But,
well, and Anthony being hurt complicates it too, because if he were here, it'd make it a lot easier, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that ultimately, if you go back to the offseason, that's not only performance and perception, but in terms of going into the season with too many outfielders. And I do think that didn't help Jarren Duran at the end of the year of doing this rotation thing. Like, that didn't help him. It finally got in the groove, and now he's out of the groove. But it's as a trade piece right now, I can't imagine that they're feeling great. It's guys, when it comes to the trade deadline, and let's like dig in on this, because we know this is the way it's going, is that if you want the best value for an Aroldis Chapman who has a bad hamstring and isn't pitching his best, or a Jarren Duran, you want them to get on a heater for the next few weeks. And if they do get on a heater, don't be seduced by it. Take advantage of it.
I'll tell you, that game on Monday did not do anything for their trade value, with Duran kicking it around the outfield and Chapman not being able to get an out. Okay, well, he's Rob Bradford. We talk to him every week, normally at 11:30. Pushed it back a little bit here today.
Thank you.
To high noon. Bradford, we appreciate you sticking around. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Okay, you can check out Rob Bradford's latest on the Odyssey app. Baseball isn't boring, and on WEEI.com. We mentioned what he wrote today about the Red Sox and the Yankees. Why can't the Red Sox be more like the Yankees?